See you next Tuesday.
Like, see you next Tuesday.
You're listening to See You Next Tuesday.
Hey, this is Brian Posehn, and you're listening to See You Next Tuesday.
See you next Tuesday.
Caca Levice.
Disciples of Troy Cyple.
Oh, Troy. We're a cool guy, Troy.
There's no way that this guy can have a normal life when you have a penis that big.
Caca-la-vice, my name is Darnian Farthwipple, but my friends call me Cool Guy Troy. My name is, in fact, Troy. This is See You Next Tuesday. Thank you so much for eavesdropping this week. It's been a great while since I've released an episode, and we'll talk about that. So much to get into, ladies and gentlemen, at the top of the show. It's 8:42 in the p.m. on November 1st. But you're probably not listening to this November 1st. In fact, I can guarantee you're not listening to this November 1st because I can't upload it from my house because I turned my internet and cable off. Why? Well, I'm going to jail next week, which is probably 85 to 90% of anyone who doesn't have internet. That's why they're going to jail next week. If this is your first time listening to the show, I got a DUI and I will be serving 90 days in jail next week. Not 90 days in next week. That would be an amazing feat. I'm not a talented DJ or comedian. That's why I podcast. Anyway, speaking of comedians, we have an excellent chat. Well, a mediocre chat on my part, but I got to talk to a great comedian named Hannibal Buress, and the man is hilarious, and he's doing very well right now. So later on in the show, I'll play that interview, which happened 6 months ago. And the thing about that interview is that it was the day I interviewed him was on my birthday, and I had a lot of shit to do that day to celebrate me. Okay, I took a day to celebrate me, Teabags Day, and we. So it was just a short thing. He was so gracious enough to do it, though, and it is what it is. So, like I said, no cable, no internet here at the house, at the condo, why do I talk into microphones, which I'll be moving out of shortly due to my incarceration. Whew. So there's a lot going on here. I'm deep in it, brother. This is real life. I'm ready to pay the piper, but in the back of my head at the same time, I'm willing to pay for my transgressions, sure. But I didn't destroy anyone's property or harm anyone or myself. And I don't know if our justice system is just anymore. So many people in jail are in there for, you know, drug possession or selling it. And we spend billions and billions of dollars every year trying to eradicate drugs. And how's that going? Of course, you know, this isn't a unique idea, and I'll leave it at that. I'll try to keep it about me. I'll do the right thing and make it about me. Either way, I've long dealt with depression and anxiety. I have panic attacks all the time, and depression is a big part of the plot of this story over here. So I'm dealing with acceptance of my fate, and that's not always good when you're always beating yourself up. And being an atheist, I don't really have a place to put faith into that, you know, one day everything will just be okay. It's on me, bro. You know, isn't it funny how you say certain words in jest and they become part of your vocabulary, bro? Anyway, I was raised in a family that my mother's side, my mother's father was a Navy man, and I never got to know him that well, but From what I understand, from other family members and what I could glean from my mother, that he was just a bear, not a large gay man, but just an overbearing personality. And so, you know, kids often parent like their parents, when they become adults. And so my mother was always very overprotective, overbearing. So I always rebelled, but, that's only one side of it. I was also a lonely kid. I grew up on, 6 acres. My parents have 6 acres still, which is great. It's like I was Christopher Robbins, wandering around in the woods every day. But, I was a lonely kid. I always envied, my friends that could walk outside at 8 a.m. in June and have a whole neighborhood full of kids to play with. I always had friends. It was just a matter of proximity. And, sorry about that. I think back now and I can recall, yeah, you know, trying to fall asleep at night, and especially in the summertime when your parents make you go to bed or reminded at, like, you know, 8 o'clock and the sun's still out. I would just sit there and be, I didn't know what it was at the time, but I just felt like there was a hole in me. So, you know, I do consider, my childhood to be, I was never abused in any way, verbally or physically. And I always had, what I needed. My parents, my father worked very hard. And me and my sister got a little older, my mom went back to work, and there was tough times in the recession in the 90s, but, you know, I can't say I come from a rough and tumble background by any means, as far as socioeconomically. Now, emotionally, like I said, my mother was overbearing, and, my father, it takes two to tango, and, for you rarely find two incredibly overbearing people in a couple, unless you're Italian. But, you know, it usually takes a more passive person to be with an overbearing person. And that's my pops. I love my pops. He's one of the smartest men I know. And, I'm a lot of him, to be honest. But, you know, he always seemed a little bit detached. If you knew my mother, you would kind of have to be to put up with it. Which, don't get me wrong, my mother is not like, I would never call her a bitch. She doesn't know. She is who she is, and she won't apologize for it. And I have plenty of traits of hers too, which I value greatly. But that was the dynamic. Communicating on an emotional level was never a priority. I'm sure it's like that in a lot of homes today, and for years and years, because that's the American thing. And I'm a boy, I'm a man. You know, we're fed with that John Wayne thing, little lady. I'm fine, thanks for asking. So I held a lot in growing up, and that's also, I think, a male teenager thing to do. But it is and was to my detriment. At 16, I found weed, which I still think is a sacred plant, not on a spiritual level, but it opens up pathways in my brain that I would never have accessed otherwise, and I can say that about a couple other psychedelics as well. But anyway, I say that to say this, you know, when I found alcohol, that was what I would fill that hole, that when I was 6 years old, laying in bed at dusk, looking out the window, when I found alcohol, that was that filled in that hole or so I thought, right? So at 18, I get out of mama's nest. I go to Millersville University in rural Pennsylvania. It's out toward Lancaster in southern Pennsylvania. So it's the first time out of the nest, you know, full time. I go to the classes My first week, I was a business major, which now, looking back, is totally batshit insane for me to do, if you know me. I went to the first week of classes and one by one stopped going to each one and just hanging out and drinking and filling that hole. And being away from my parents, who even as a in my late teens, I did not get along with well, even that you take that safety net for granted. So I was completely on my own now. And I had friends, of course, always had friends, but I was on that man up shit and never really connected. Maybe a handful of times on mushrooms, but on when you drink with your buds, you don't really, we didn't do the male bonding thing. We would wild out. Yeah. I mean, son, you digs. So college. Yeah. I was there at Millersville first semester. I finally called my mom a week before finals to tell her that I didn't really do much, of anything when it came to school, work, or anything in between that, except drinking and getting fucked up and doing a little fucking. Let's not forget, get a little taste of the tang. But anyway, came home with my tail between my legs and didn't find solace in leaving, because I went back to that safety net, but wasn't what I really needed for me on the inside, if you can glean my psychobabble, very meta my talking. But I just continued to drink, and my parents finally noticed this, and at age 20, I went down to Florida to an inpatient rehab. But it was just, looking back, I was drinking as much as all my friends, and my parents are so old-fashioned, and they came from small rural towns, one from Delaware and one from upstate Pennsylvania, that to them, this was out-of-control behavior. And honestly, you know, I was a heavy drinker, but at the same time, I was drinking as much as any 20-year-old would, and it is rampant these days. I'm not justifying it, kids these days. So I went to inpatient rehab, and I was the only one there who was like strictly a weed and alcohol guy. All these people, it was an amazing experience. I'll write about it sometime. Mostly heroin or crack, and Jesus fuck, I will never, I learned a lot about people from that, and I learned a lot about pain and other people's pain, and that was the first kind of break in my depression that I didn't even have a name for it back then, but and it's different from watching Toddlers and Tiaras or My Strange Addiction and feeling better about yourself from watching other people. It's different because you're in a room with another person, and a person who is powerless over a substance, truly powerless, and they're looking you in the eye and you're feeling their pain. It's not voyeuristic. Like I said, it's totally different from sitting on your couch and feeling better about yourself because of these ridiculous people on television. It's, you're right there. And I shared myself with them too. Of course, I'm not saying that. Honestly, I think everyone could benefit from a quote unquote rehab of some sort. Everyone's got their shit going, right? If you don't agree, then turn this podcast off. Shame on you and the horse you rode in on. And I apologize for the lack of comedy in this episode. I have a lot on my mind, and this is my soapbox. And maybe you can get something out of this as well. So, as far as that piece, I'll leave it there for now. I have a couple more episodes where I'll return to my little story, I guess. I don't know. And hopefully with some comedy. But now, let's listen to my meager attempt at an interview with an incredible comedian named Hannibal Buress. My guest today is a former writer on Saturday Night Live and current writer on the almighty 30 Rock, as well
as... Not current anymore, man.
What's that?
Nope. You have to do your research, Troy.
I'm fucking off the bat, son.
Off the bat, man.
Fill us in. What happened?
I left.
Okay, fair enough. But you, just the same, are an incredible stand-up. And
thank you, man.
Seems like you're a thorough-ass dude, too. But you go from Jimmy Kimmel on Wednesday night to an obscure free podcast today. So I think it's safe to say you've arrived, right?
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
But, I didn't know you left 30 Rock. But tell us... let's work chronologically. Who were the comedians growing up that made you think, like, that's something I would want to do, or made you think that's something I have to do?
It was the comedians that inspired me were the horrible open mic comedians at my college, so they inspired me to think that I could also be as horrible as them, and I pursued that.
And you excelled at it.
I excelled at being horrible early on.
What about your first time? How'd that go? Like, did you go in with 5 minutes your first time?
About that, I think. A few minutes, yeah.
How'd it go?
It wasn't so-so. I mean, it wasn't a high-pressure situation where I could really, really fail.
Yeah.
It was a small crowd of other performers and their friends, so it was a supportive environment. And I got a couple chuckles, and that was enough to keep me going.
Exactly. Right on. Your set was awesome last night, I have to say, without getting on your jack too much, but it was great. And
thank you.
You
usually crowds get on my first day of a run, and if I traveled that day, they usually get a mediocre show. But I guess the crowd was good, and it worked out because I'm usually pretty tired.
Right on. I'm sorry.
But I was able to. It went all right. It went pretty well.
It went better than all right. And you said you got into town at like 6:40, and it was an early show, 8:00. That must kind of suck. Like, how long have you been on the road thus far this time?
I've been on the road pretty steady since April, I guess. March, April. I mean, I've had short breaks where I go to New York for a few days, but... Uh-huh. Beyond that, yeah, I've been traveling pretty heavy for the past 3 months or so.
Does it wear you down? Are you one of the comedians that, like, lives on the road, or do you like having a home base?
I mean, I like having a home base, but it's also necessary as far as just building your base, and people want to see you live, so I like to get out to the cities and bring the show to people and do my thing. So it can get a little tiring, but... now a lot of the cities that I'm going to, I've been to before, so I have friends in the city, so I get to hang out and go out, and so that makes it a lot better.
Right,
the road can be lonely sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, I mean, I guess the advantage to the writing jobs you had is, well, number one, security, and probably health insurance, and at the same time, it's kind of, you know, I guess you kind of have to curtail your stand-up schedule for that. Which do you like better? Do you enjoy the writing gigs, or does that become a little... Go ahead.
The writing gigs were fun. It was really cool because I was a fan of both of those shows. So it was nice to work on them. But I started out as a stand-up, so that's my true passion. But I did learn a lot about writing while on those shows, and got some information that, you know, hopefully helped me with developing my own show in the future. And it also helped with my stand-up writing.
Sure, sure. And that is definitely a show I would like to watch. But how does a writer get a gig on SNL? Because, like, you know, did you audition with stand-up or a writing piece?
Well, performed on Jimmy Fallon in 09, and they liked that set, and then they offered me a gig from that. But people have gotten the gig at SNL in different ways. Sometimes
right.
A couple people have auditioned for cast, and then they got hired as writers.
Like
some
Tina.
People got asked to submit, and then they submitted a packet and got in like that. Maybe some people. So there's various ways that people have gotten it.
Right, right. Did you meet with Lorne Michaels?
I did meet with him. Seth Meyers and Steve Higgins, who's a producer there.
And Seth Meyers, he's the head writer still, right?
Yeah, he's the head writer.
Okay. What was your experience with Lorne Michaels? I've heard, you know, depends on the person. I've heard a lot of contradictory stories, but what about you, per se?
I didn't deal with him that much because I didn't have many sketches on, so that's when you have to really deal with him. Right. But, you know, he's the boss there, and it was cool to watch him work in between Dress and Air. He's making a lot of changes on the fly. He sees a lot of stuff that I wouldn't see. A lot of us didn't, as far as certain things with lighting or blocking in the sketches and different lines, and he'll make those changes and cuts, and it usually would work. You see what he saw when the sketch comes out on the Air show. It's way better.
It's amazing how that show is just legendary for fixing things on the fly, and sometimes when shit goes wrong, that's like the unknown, the funniest shit, you know. You know, some people get mad at like Jimmy Fallon for breaking all the time, but some people like it too. It lets the audience know that the performer's having a good time.
It's kind of fun to watch people break.
Who did you write with on SNL? Or four.
I didn't have a regular person that I wrote with because that was there my first year, so I didn't have a person that I wrote with all the time.
Right on. About how many sketches made it on?
A couple things.
Right on. But it was a good experience, I imagine. And
yeah, it was a fun time. Yeah.
And that how did that transition into 30 Rock?
Somebody recommended that I meet with Tina and Robert Carlock, and so I met with them and sent over some material, and a couple weeks later they offered me the job there.
Oh, that's cool. And so what's your next project? Like, do you want to stick with TV, or do you want to stick with your bread and butter stand-up? Or
right now I'm focusing on stand-up and performing and see what other, I mean, I'll write for some other projects, kind of as a
punch up
maybe, and just not as a staff writer, but maybe sending stuff in.
Okay.
But for the most part, right now, just focusing on stand up.
Right on. And last night, you came out and you did some awesome crowd work about Delaware, and
yeah.
I heard like a couple. Bits from your album My Name Is Hannibal, which is came out when last August?
Yeah.
Okay. And I heard like, but most of it was shit I hadn't heard from that, which is awesome. Is that, are you working on the like a new act or?
Yeah, that's stuff I'm working on, stuff for the new album now.
Cool. And how long, like, are you, I don't know, like how you work, do the, when you're writing a new act, do you kind of transition as new material comes? Do you like trade it out with the older stuff, or do you write, do you add chunks at a time and remove them, or?
It just depends on the show. When the show is going well and it's flowing, I'm kind of more apt to try the newer stuff and throw in.
Right.
New stuff, but sometimes a show can be going rough, and I'm thinking, oh man, I gotta dig back into some stuff.
Yeah.
But then that doesn't even feel right, because that stuff, I don't perform it anymore, and I think what I'm doing now is a little bit, it's just in tone, maybe a little bit different, so when I do something, some of the bits from the CD, it doesn't feel the same to me, at least.
It kind of like changes the momentum.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. But it's all good to me. I liked it all. What You are, today's my birthday. I'm 28 today. We're both children of 1983. Thank you. It's just another fucking day. But, like, you know, I like you so much, but, you know, it's kind of depressing because I'm trying to break into comedy, and it's, what's your advice for starting out in a smaller city like Philly? I mean, I know eventually I'm going to have to move to where the work is, but what could I learn that you learned starting out that I wouldn't know?
The thing I did while I was in Chicago was I would just perform as much as I could, you know?
Right. That's what everybody says, stage time.
And just get comfortable, and I'll perform at all types of open mics. I would do music open mics and poetry open mics. And
like the quote-unquote alternative shows?
Well, no. I'm just talking about just as far as open mics. I would go to all types of open mics.
Oh, I hear you. Just even music.
Yeah, music open mics, because they would give you longer sets, because people do three songs usually.
Yeah.
So
yeah, sure.
It's a five-minute set at a comedy open mic.
Right.
And plus, they're musicians, so they're not, you know, with comedy open mics, sometimes the people could be just looking in the notebooks and kind of focus on their stuff. But with a musician crowd or a poetry crowd, they can be more like a real audience.
Yeah, definitely, because it's something different. I did 5 minutes. My buddy's in like a metal band, and he was like, "Well, a band dropped out, so I did it in front of them," and it kind of. They were more attentive than they would have been if I was, you know, the host for a comedy show, you know. So that is good advice. There's plenty of shit around here. But how long did you do comedy before you decided to move, like, to New York?
About 6 years or so.
Okay. And were you like a touring comedian at that point?
A little bit, not full, well, just about full time.
Right.
Well, I was doing a mixture of feature work and headliner work and some college, but it wasn't heavy, but it was enough to get me by. But it was off and on.
Did you still did you have another job at the time, or were you strictly comedy?
Strictly comedy, yeah.
Cool. And with the middlers, the feature acts, like. Does the headliner pick them to go on the road, or is that like more management job?
It depends on the city and the club. Sometimes I bring my own open act, and then sometimes the club books their people. It just depends on what the club is, what they're doing. It varies.
Very cool. Well, I'd love to talk to you for longer, but, I unfortunately have stuff to do, and you have your job to do tonight. But man, it's really great to talk to you. It's not often I get to talk to someone who's like, I'm not just trying to, you know, suck your dick, but you're fucking an inspiration, really. You're my age, and you've done shit that I respect, and you've worked for, you know, shows that I really like. And so thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate you talking to me today.
No problem, man.
And maybe we can have you on in a couple months. I'll hit you up.
But, all right, for sure.
All right, man. Have a great show tonight.
All right, thank you.
Hannibal Buress, ladies and gentlemen. And I want to thank him for just doing some no-name dude's podcast the day after he did Jimmy Kimmel. And I felt like an asshole that I didn't know he had left 30 Rock. But there you have it. And also, I'd like to thank Stephen Bray from Seattle, for his generous donation. He's the reason you're hearing this episode and, the few that I will be putting out before I head off to my, impending doom. So I'd like to play you out with this song. It's a Johnny Cash cover. It's a song written by Nick Lowe. Please excuse my guitar playing suffers when I sing at the same time. But thank you so much for eavesdropping. And until we meet again, keep your powder dry. The beast in me caged by frail and fragile bars. Restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. The beast in me. From the rain, and in the twinkling of an eye, might have to be restrained. God help the beast in me. Sometimes it tries to kid me that it's just a teddy bear, and even somehow manage to vanish in the air. And that is when I must beware of the beast in me. That everybody knows. They've seen him out dressed in my clothes, patently unclear. If it's New York, oh, New Year. God help the beast in me.